Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Hi, my name is Lone Lee, and I am an editor, a senior editor at Atria Books. I'm also an author, the author of A Foot of Love Story, and then the upcoming Solving for the Unknown.
Thank you so much for coming on, and I want to congratulate you for 10 years at Simon & Schuster, which is Atria's parent company. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah. Thank you so much. It's really exciting. I can't believe it, really.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can only imagine 10 years, a decade goes by with the blink of an eye, right?
Oh, yeah. I used to wonder at my, like, with my other colleagues, you know, some of them have been there for 25 years, 35 years. And then I used to think, how is that possible? But it's possible. Time just passes by so quickly, especially if you're, like, really comfortable in your current company, I guess.
Yeah. And comfortable, you mean, like, you really love the work, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I totally love it. And it's a place where I consider it as a place of where I grew up, because I really started from the very beginning as an entry level employee, as an editorial assistant, and then just moved up the editorial ladder to senior editor now. And I feel as if I finally found my place where I can acquire the books that I love. I'm surrounded by people that I grew up with, I guess, as well. So I'm really thankful. And again, I'm in shock.
Yeah. I consider the writing world and the film world two of my favorite places to sit and talk with guests in the Vietnamese community, especially the Vietnamese American community. Film people and book people are so fascinating to me. And somebody in your position, I'm deeply interested in how you got to where you got. But there's two tracks that you are part of. You're part of the writing track as well as the publishing sort of executive. And I want to see if we can explore, both those directions and how you found yourself in both those worlds. I know they're obviously intertwined.
They are. But I think I unofficially was a writer first. I think all my life, you know, I was an introvert. I'm the youngest of three. So I was very quiet. I think I always was a daydreamer in the family too. I couldn't pay attention very well. So I was always making up stories in my head. So I always had that in me of like writing stories in order to understand the world, in order to entertain myself. But I never saw myself as a writer, an author, until probably seriously in college. I was intending to pursue a journalism track. I wanted to be a journalist, so my major in college was journalism, and I was on the newspaper, and I really, for the longest time, thought I would do that, but then I was able to get a internship at Simon & Schuster, where I currently work, actually. I got my internship when I was the summer before my junior year, and I was able to be an editorial intern where I, you know, was shadowing a editor who was reading submissions. I got to second edit behind her. I was able to sit in on editorial board meetings and hear what editors were reading and things that they were loving. And from there, I think that's where I was like, okay, I think I'm going to be an editor. And I sort of, as I was still writing and things, I was sort of pushed back a little bit. I was like, oh, I just want to work with authors. I want to support their career. I really wanted to discover writers. So that's like my, after college, I was able to get a job at Simon & Schuster as an editorial assistant. And I really loved the job at first, but then eventually I missed writing. I was just, I wanted to still explore myself. I wanted to still feel creative in some ways because, you know, even if I entered publishing, it's still sort of a corporate world. You're sitting in front of a desk, you're answering emails, scheduling things, and I just needed something to break that pattern. So I actually went back to school for my master's in creative writing, and I was writing short stories then. And I felt as if, like, as I was working in publishing and then also going back to school and sort of relearning storytelling and meeting so many different writers, it just helped me feel so grounded, so excited to see, to check out future writers and just feel creative, but also be able to work well, efficiently. So I think my writing path was really supported by my time in the MFA program. I was writing short stories. After I graduated from the MFA program, I wanted to continue that sort of workshop feeling where you're able to sit there and listen to writers talk about their work. So within publishing, I actually started a writing chapter where people in publishing, no matter what department, editorial, marketing, managing editorial, publicity, they can have a space where they can write and then talk about writing. And I think from there, that's where my editor had found me. My editor, my original editor, Jennifer Ung, who's Cambodian American, she was like hearing about this workshop and hearing about me as a writer, as someone who was writing Vietnamese American stories. And she actually approached me and asked if I wanted to work with her on an idea. And we sort of developed the idea together. And that's how a love story came to be, actually. It came because there was an editor who is really committed to publishing diverse voices and diverse voices with ideas that haven't been explored. So Vietnamese American identity, I think it's still being explored, especially in the YA category. And she was just committed to that. So she actually was one who opened the doors for me. And I'm always thankful for Jennifer. She's just simply, she's still in publishing. She's an editorial director now, and she's no longer my editor, but I just am so grateful for her. And I think that's the shortish kind of summary of how I began.
Now, there are, I don't even know where to begin with the questions because I want to, I want to know how things get published, but then I also want to know how do we know if things are good? You know, maybe if we start with how do we know stories are good and the writing is good, if we start there, then we can probably go into the next thing, which is once we can identify a good story, a good author, how does that person, that book, that manuscript move up the chain of command?
Okay. I guess a good story, it really, for me, I feel as if I fall in love with a manuscript if it's like maybe the first 50 pages are really solid. The first 50 pages make me feel as if I'm reading a book in the bookstore already. It makes me feel as if I really know the character so well. Like I know what they want. I know how they're going to get it. I know sort of what obstacles are in their way. I think my authors, especially, they just know the inner life so well, where we're inside the character's head, and the character might be observing something that we all observe on a daily basis, but they're just thinking about it in a different way. Or maybe they like voice a thought that we've always thought but never felt like we could say out loud.
why does that sound so incredibly simple, but it's so incredibly hard.
It's so hard. Yeah. Because it makes you, when authors do that, it makes you feel as if they're talking directly at you, to you. It makes you feel as if like you've met your like soulmate or, you know, and that's hard to do, obviously. But I mean, authors tend to do that so many times. I think for me, a good story is also, it's building off of something that we sort of see as stereotypical and then adding a bit of like something else. An example would be like a love story, I guess, a love story where, okay, you have two people who are in love and they need to get together, but there's obstacles in their way. But there's a book that I'm publishing that is a love story, but it's a love story between an immortal woman and a time traveling man. So it's like, yeah, the obstacles are there, but the obstacles are totally different from what mm-hmm. we experience normally. It's time itself. Wow. They're really literally up against time. So it's taking something normal and like elevating it. That's my sort of, it's catnip to me. Let's see. A good story is also, yeah, like the author knows their style. Like they lean into it. They don't really stick to conventions. One of my other authors, they actually don't use, they didn't use quotation marks in their debut novel, like in dialogue itself. Like the dialogue was sort of combined into narrative. There was no dialogue tag, like he said, she said. It was just in a paragraph, and then you can just read narrative, dialogue, narrative. And of course, there were people who did not like that, but for the most part, and for me, like they were like, "Oh wow, it just was so seamless the way that we could read and transition between dialogue and narrative." So that author, Scott Alexander Howard, who wrote The Other Valley, he just leaned into it. He didn't really care about like what other people would say about it. He just knew that it felt right for his story. So, he went with it. I think that's like what's coming up right now. Yeah. Like stories that just like, they sort of single out the reader.
So now that you have described what makes things intriguing and interesting, how do you take it to the next step? Because let's say you get these submissions and you're like reading and a lot of things move you, but what if it moves you but you're like, wait, this is not going to make money for the company, it's not going to make money or an ROI for what we put down in terms of dollars, and we're not going to get the readership, but it's really good. I mean, that's an issue too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I always think that if I say no to this project, someone else will say yes. Because I am one editor in the industry, just one person. So I always think positively and say, like, if it's not for me, it's for someone else who can see the story so well, who can help this writer flourish, who can invest their time to make this writer feel as if this editor is on their side. Because, you know, when we're teaming up with a writer, for me personally, I think of like their long-term path of like, will I love the story for like 2 years or more? Because that's sort of like, I mean, I guess a year or more, but I think I want to work with them on this book, but then also the next. So I just think about like, I imagine myself on their side for that many years.
I was just going to ask what makes a good editor, but I think that's what makes a good editor, you know,
someone on your team willing to stick with you through all the ups and downs.
Fall into big savings all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each, then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Long vision for your career, somebody who wants to
see
you grow as an artist and your work get deeper.
Yeah, Yeah, that's true.
I literally was going to ask that. Like, what do you think makes a good publisher, a good editor? And you just answered it. I mean, it's like clearly, cool. Clearly what makes somebody good on your side in your work is the amount of love and care that you have for the artist that you're working with, the writer you're working with.
Yeah. And I would say that I'm constantly surprised by the growth in my authors. I think one of the authors who came on this podcast, Carolyn Nguyen, who wrote The Fortunes of Jaded Woman, that was her debut, right? And that was like a huge hit book club pick for GMA. And I actually just acquired her third book, which is actually totally different from her first and her second, actually. It's, you know, her first and second are both, I would define them as family dramedies, where it has both a lot of humor, but also a lot of heart. But her third one is sort of in the speculative space where it imagines a world where women are running everything and men are not, and they're now lonely. There's an epidemic of male loneliness. Wow. So there's a department that pairs up willing bachelorettes with these wealthy men. And in return, the women get, you know, a good salary or like very, like a lot of protection, and they live inside this small community. And there's this woman who agrees to do all of this, and she feels as if she's safe now, but she realizes that women within the division, they're getting murdered. So now she's like, what's happening to the world? What's happening? What's going to happen to me? So it's a concept that, like, I never thought Carolyn would think of this, but she thought of it. She wrote pages that were just so amazing and so solid. And I was like, okay, let's go again, you know? So that's what I love, being surprised by my authors. And
I am continually living in awe of Carolyn. I see her at events all the time here in LA, and she's such an awesome person. She's funny. She's dynamic. Awesome. She's witty. She's just a terrific, terrific human being. And the success that she is receiving is so well deserved.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'm so proud of her. I wish I could see her more often, except we're on opposite sides of the country. But I have been able to see her maybe like 3 times or so. So
how did she, let's use Carolyn as an example. How did she come to you? Or you came to her? I mean, how did it work?
Yeah, I mean, so I believe, this is 2020. So I believe my agent, I mean, her agent, Stephanie Kim, was the one who queried me and asked, hey, like, I have this author, I have this pitch, would you want to see it? It was the...
And does Stephanie and you have a relationship? So the agent...
No, this was actually the first time I heard from her. Yes, cold query, never met her in person. I knew of her name, but we never had a discussion yet. So she was just querying me and saying, hey, I have a Vietnamese American writer who wrote this amazing story. And I was like, yeah, let's do this. Like, let me see it. And the thing is, I think Carolyn had mentioned this to you, so hopefully I'm not revealing it. I'm not revealing anything, but I actually turned this down once because the submission that I read, it was really wonderful, really witty. I felt like the structure was so broad, and it felt as if, I would say it was like a linked story, a short story collection versus a novel. So it didn't feel as complete as I wanted it to be. So what happened was I sent in my notes to the agent who communicated it to Carolyn. And I think it was within a month or so, she took these notes, ran with it, and came back with a revision that just blew me away. Where she did take some of my notes, but also added in her own revisions that were inspired by my notes, which I also love, because obviously my edits are sort of like a starting point. They're not meant to be final. They're meant to sort of inspire the writer. So she did that. She like was inspired by some of my notes and made her own changes. And that was when I was like, okay, so editors don't often send in notes to manuscripts that they pass on, just because they know that, oh, you know, maybe the manuscript's going to be read by other editors, and then those editors will, I don't know, the author might want to go elsewhere. But Carolyn had taken my notes to heart, and she was really committed to it. And the revision was just something that I felt that I could work with for a year or more. And I think the publication process from there was pretty easy, because I think within the publishing house, it's really important to make noise, especially as a younger editor. I think at the time I wasn't a full editor yet. I think I was on the verge of becoming the full editor. I think I was still someone on someone else's desk, but then also building up my list of books I want to publish. So it was important to me to be like very aggressive in terms of like pushing this book to everyone to read inside the house and being clear about like why I love this book so much. So I remember writing this long note, just expressing why I wanted to work with Carolyn, what part of the manuscript spoke to me. And, you know, it was about Vietnamese American women, daughters and aunties, and the complicated relationship between everyone. And that's something that I personally have gone through with my family. So I made sure to sort of make clear about like how I was personally moved by Carolyn's story. Right. So after I did that, that's sort of, I think I was really aggressive. Yeah, I said aggressive. And I was following up with people to read. The people who have to read are obviously people part of Atria, like the publisher, the publicity and marketing team. But at that point, they're already totally on board because they read the manuscript. So the next step is to make the salespeople who eventually go to talk to people at Amazon, BNN, and the indie stores to make sure that they read it and fall in love with it too. Wow. So I was sending notes to them.
So even before it gets printed, it goes out to buyers before it's even printed to see if there's validation there.
Yeah, for sure.
I never knew that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. It's a very, yeah, there's so many things behind the scenes.
Oh my God,
so wow. So it's really important for them to get on board as well. Getting the excitement.
This is a completed manuscript that is done by the author, the first draft, and then it goes out to Amazon and Barnes & Noble's and small bookstores to get sort of like the reading, the temperature out in the real world.
It's the final draft. So the first draft is like, we've already worked on it, mm-hmm. Me and Carolyn, and now the manuscript is out to copy editors where it's like they're doing the fine edits, the fine like grammar, punctuation, proper things that sort of, the smaller things that wouldn't change what the book is. So at that point, yeah, the manuscript it's not finished as in it's still in like Word doc form. It's not like print, like laid out as a book page yet. But yeah, at that point people are beginning to read.
And does the buyers ever decline and say, hey, that this book is not, or is it used as an instrument to detect sort of demographics, sort of to gauge the numbers?
I think at the point, yeah, it's to gauge the numbers. We're also, when we're sending the manuscript out, it's also saying like this book is the next X, or like this book would reach the audience of X. And I think at the time, we pitched it as a for readers of Kevin Kwan, who wrote Crazy Rich Asians. And then, like Emma Straub, because they had the drama of the interpersonal relationships. And
so you're saying,
yeah, so it's like the readership. Like,
yeah, comps, yeah. And titles that are comps, yeah. To this book. Incredible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds labor intensive. Because you got to do your work, right? As an editor, you're doing your, you know, you're doing your part, and then the writer has to do their part, and then you send it back out to your own internal team. They got to do their part. And then all these other people have to do their part to get, it's like a village that comes together to get this.
Total village. I think of it as giving birth because, mm-hmm. There's so many people involved in birthing a new book. yeah, it's like, I also say that editing is like, happens to be a big part of my job, but still a small percentage in terms of like the time we take, because when we're not editing, we're participating in cover meetings, meeting with our marketing publicity team, writing notes to BNN or Amazon. And that happens to be for books, the projects that we already have and are working to launch. But then at the same time, we are acquiring, where we're looking for books. We're looking for more books to buy. So we're talking to agents a lot. We're reading tons of submissions. I think for me right now, my submission count, it's like, I think I've received maybe 250 submissions so far this year of completed manuscripts. And I'm actually working my way through. I think I've probably replied to like 80% of those, and the others are in process, in progress, or like things that I'm going after. So.
But you, there's no way to finish all the manuscripts that come in, right? You're only probably reading the first 50 pages. If it works for you or not.
Exactly. Yeah. First 50 pages is definitely my benchmark. Sometimes you get it where it's like, you get it that it's like the writing is maybe not there yet. So you can put it down when it's like 10, 30 pages. And it's hard to balance all this. I always think about my authors and like, and they've just put so much work into this manuscript, and I want the best for them. So I think of them. I think of my children. I don't have children, but I think of, you know, this is what I why I do it. Like, I want my authors to be happy. I want them to feel as if they have worth. I want them to, like, all those years of turmoil, like just working on one book for years and years and years and neglecting part of their own lives probably. And I want them to just feel like it's all worth it.
Yeah.
So
now, is the industry, because there's so much distraction, there's digital things that are happening and that are affecting the film industry. I can imagine book readership is being affected. Is book publishing a healthy, are we on a healthy track, or is the trajectory good? Because sort of in the film world, you could argue that, you know, box office and certain kind of movies are hurting today because of there's just so much content to consume online.
Mm-hmm. I feel like a few years ago, we were all afraid because ebooks were getting popular. I think at that time, ebooks, we were thinking, oh, print is going to be dead. Like, no one's going to buy hardcovers and printed books. So we might as well just, like, you know, transition into ebook only kind of mentality. Yeah. But surprisingly, no, like, print sales are pretty still siloed, because print sales, there's something about having a book in your hand versus something digital, something very sterile. You're able to, like, smell the books, you're able to see, like, feel the book and the pages, and like, and seeing, like, maybe like the font of the book. I mean, the font matters for me because it's interior design. Interior designers work so hard, and they're the unsung heroes, because they really match the font with the book and what it feels like. I think there's something special about holding that product in your hand, and I think a lot of people still love that feeling. Marking up the pages. Yeah. Making it yours.
Yeah.
I tend to write in my books as well, in the margins. And I also sometimes take the jacket off and like keep it elsewhere. I also obviously don't like throw it away, because that's like the cover designer's work. But it's a keepsake. So I still keep it. It's a special product. So I feel like there's people out there who want to avoid the digital part and feel grounded in the tangible. And I feel like there's going to always be people like that. I mean, if you're looking at trends now, like, there's people who are like reverting back to like the 90s, where like 90s fashion. I've seen people with Walkman and, like, you know, just walking and just those things of the past will always sort of resurface in very strange ways.
Yeah.
And I feel like books, print books, will always have a place. I personally have never felt as if book publishing will be gone. I feel as if this industry will always be around.
Yeah.
So in general, I feel pretty positively. And I think I would, I'm an anxious person. So I think that I have to think positively or else I won't be able to just function.
Now, what can you talk about the stages of, you know, a writer has an idea for a book. From that idea to actually book on the shelves, can we talk about that? And can you walk me through that process?
Ooh, yes, yes, yes. Okay, so let's see. The writer gets an idea. And the idea is, I mean, the idea could be like something as simple as like a gesture, something they hear inside their head and through their inner voice. Like they can think of for me personally, I think of, I hear a voice that like a dialogue, a certain line. Some people see it as gestures, like something that they see a person doing something and that's sort of the motion that starts the story. So they stick with the idea. They sort of sit with it for a little while. Maybe they walk with it a little. They sort of remove themselves from their like own lives and they think about the story. They think that they're living someone else's life. So they're going to a cafe, but not at themselves, but like as someone, as their character. And maybe they would observe the people around them and the characters would like act a certain way. And then instead of them thinking about the people in front of them, it's the character observing them. So they're sort of like being the character and living their world. I think from there, when you know the character and you know like what they're going through, that's sort of when you would form a concept or like a hook. Like this character is XXX, so this character wants to be XXX, but this obstacle is in the way XXX. So there has to be like a desire. The character has to have a specific desire. They're going to have a plan to get to that desire, to fulfill that desire, but there's something that's going to be in the way.
So basically every story is that basically has that.
Yeah. In general.
Hero's journey.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how it makes it interesting. I think one of the things I learned in my MFA program is that like, happy stories are boring essentially. There has to be some struggle in there. Yeah. There has to be some drama.
Tension.
So there has to be like, I think that's like the reason why we would want to read this book. Like we want it to be interesting in some ways. We don't want it to be boring. So after they figure out that sort of like one line thing of like, so I was saying about the time travel story, about the love story between a immortal woman and a time traveling man. Yeah, like you could put that into the one line of like an immortal woman and a time traveler fall in love, but they find themselves time is getting in the way, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I could say that more eloquently, but I'm just coming up with a spot. Coming up with something right now, but there's always that but in the story.
Yeah, so this is a log line you're describing, right?
Yeah we call it a keynote, but yeah, log line is basically the same thing. It's that quick elevator pitch. It's the thing that lets us know the person and the plot and also the genre too.
And even in memoirs that exists as well.
I would think so, yeah. I used to work with memoirs, but not anymore. But yeah, it is that too. And sometimes it helps to, in keynotes, to include like themes sort of like, you know, this book is about this and this and this. And an example of someone exploring intergenerational trauma, racism, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes people do that too, of including themes, except if you lead with themes, I think that's just boring. I think there needs to be a person there, an agent. So they have their idea and, you know, there's some people who outline, some people who don't. I personally outline, and I usually call my outline written in sand because I write it down. I write everything that I imagine that will happen in the book, but I don't stick with it so closely. Like I can change a few things. And that's sort of the generating process of writing. Like you are putting down the bones of the story, the plot. You have the beginning, middle, end. There has to be a climax. There has to be a conclusion. And from there, I guess after they put down the first draft, where they have a solid beginning, middle, end, that's when they revise. Revising can take actually longer than generating, I think, because you're actually, sometimes you're just word vomiting as you're writing it and generating, and then the revision is the more precise part of the writing process where you have to be like, oh, do these pieces all fit? Like the events leading up to the from the beginning to the middle, do they make sense? Do they get the character where they need to be? Or are they reaching the climax a little early? Have I looked at all the plot holes in the book? Have I really shown that the character has changed in some ways? You're just asking so many questions and realizing you haven't answered most of them.
Right.
So that revision process could take a long time. And at that point, it's like, I think it's healthy for writers to step away from the work a little, like, because during the generating process, you're like so in the story, you can't really see your blind spots. So I think it's necessary to remove yourself a little, maybe work on something else, maybe don't write at all. Maybe just go back to reading. Maybe go back to not neglecting your family, friends, yourself. but then after a while, you come back to the story because obviously writers, they can't stay away from their work for too long. It's like their precious thing, their treasure. So they need to go back to it. And once they do, maybe they'll see a different way to move forward in their story. They can get new ideas. I think the revision process, I take it literally as revision, where you are daydreaming the story, daydreaming about the story. Yeah. There's so many stories. Just what I also love about stories is that like, there's so many ways to do things. Like there's no one solution. So you're always asking yourself, what if I do this? What if I do that?
Process. But this is it could be a debilitating issue where you have so many different directions. How does a writer or an artist stick on one sort of path? How do you know if you're on the right path? Because you're getting thrown all of these new revision ideas. How do you know which is the right one?
That's a hard question. I really think it's just all down to gut. It just feels right. It just feels as if, like, I also think of, like, writing. Like, when you go back to your writing and you revisit your writing and you feel as if someone else wrote it, I think that's a good sign. Because you like,
yeah,
that means that you aren't in the story as much. Like you're not making it, it's not obviously written by you. It's like, it feels as if you were just let, someone else had taken the story and like just went off in a different direction, but made it work. I think it's down to gut, honestly. Like I said, there's so many ways, but obviously we always have to make a choice. And I think that choice is like, I think the writer knows when that choice is made.
Yeah. So it's an intuitive guttural thing.
I think so. Yeah. I really think so. Sorry to any writers who are watching this and being like, how should I do that? And it's really up to you.
And then, so, all right, once you get all of this, at what point are you looking for an agent? At what point are you looking for a publisher, editor, all of that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes before people reach out to agents, they actually have their close friends reading. Like, I think it's like a beta read where maybe you have a writing group or something and people read parts of the manuscript and they offer their notes. And I think it's a good sign if your readers are saying the same thing about an issue. Because that means, yeah, so this is definitely something you have to fix. But sometimes you get like multiple opinions from readers, and that gets a little confusing. So I think that's where you kind of have to trust your gut in that situation. I mean, yeah, if multiple readers are saying things about everything, then that's a sign. But like, if it's like, I don't know, three readers are saying the same thing, saying something about the same thing, and then there's like one reader who's saying this, like maybe trust the people who are in the majority. After that, and you revise, to look for an agent, I think writers should read books that feel similar to theirs, the comp titles. And I feel like people have to read more recent comps versus old comps, because in the industry, we do tend to go to recent comps because it shows us the most up-to-date data on like who the readers are and like the age and demographics and stuff. So it's just easier to understand who are the current readers will be and how we reach them. And after reading those books, they can check out in the acknowledgement page in the back. There's always a mention about the agent, and I always tell readers, prospective authors, to read those books and then see who the agents are. Because agents tend to, they also have a list of like the types of books they love. So there's agents who acquire mostly speculative work. There's agents who acquire mostly romance. So there's a good chance that they're looking for works like yours. And you can find those in the back of the books. You could also, I mean, a lot of agents are online now. So that's how they, you know, you can search agents and look at their bio and see how to query them. They have there are always like email addresses, so you can see who you can submit your cover letter to. And then some agents prefer to get the cover letter and then like first 10 pages.
Yeah.
Some prefer partial manuscripts that are like maybe 100 pages. It really depends on the agent. But from there, that's sort of, I'm trying to remember. So I used to intern when I was younger at an agency, and what I did was I read through the slush pile, and I read emails where there's some writers who are very, you can tell that they have a high opinion of themselves because they compare themselves to like Ernest Hemingway and like the greats of the past kind of thing. And I'm like, okay, don't do that.
That's a no-no then.
That's a no-no no matter what industry. Like you can't do that in the film industry either, you know? Like,
you can't put your name in the same sentence as Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's something you shouldn't do. But there's some writers who wrote wonderful cover letters where they have a perfect log line. That's really interesting. They mention comp titles that are fairly recent. And they just were able to write their pitch in interesting ways, like a short one-page pitch letter that included like how many words this book has, what category it is, and you know, the character and the plot. And there's so many examples online that people can follow.
Yeah. And now that there's so many Vietnamese writers in the world in America now, does being Vietnamese as a writer affect the way you pick up sort of interest in a book or a manuscript for you personally?
For me personally, yeah. I mean, I think I'm like, oh, like what's this? Like it's sort of a warm feeling to recognize a Vietnamese name and be like, hey, you know, like look at we're here kind of thing. So for me, yeah, I think I'm personally swayed by just like the name itself, and then I'm interested in the book, but that doesn't guarantee that I'll publish it. Obviously, I think I still use that like editor mind of like, is this writing solid? Like, is there a different style here? Are there readers out there for this type of story? So I still judge it by being an editor and someone who wants to work with the writer long term.
And the idea of, you know, even if it's a high quality manuscript and you really feel connected to it, but the powers at the upper echelon of bean counting and money and trying to figure out if this is a commercially viable book. How does that play in when we're just a tiny fragment percentage of the United States? So I guess the question for me, I'm coming at it from, I always ask the creatives that are like gatekeeping, basically like you, I hate to say it that way. And yeah. I don't mean it in an offensive way.
We are.
Yeah. As a gatekeeper, you're looking, first of all, it has to like hit this benchmark or this criteria of quality. But then the other side of it is like, well, you got to put on the, you know, the executive hat if this is going to make money and make sense for our company. But the Vietnamese sort of topic in the United States is we're only like a tiny percent, not even a percent of the entire country is Vietnamese. So where does that sort of decision making from a publishing hat happen for you?
I mean, like when I picked up the story, when I picked up Carolyn's story, I wasn't necessarily thinking like, I was thinking that it was for readers who are of Vietnamese descent, but I wasn't thinking about them only. I was thinking that it has potential to reach beyond that readership. I think a lot of people will respond to the story because it is about motherhood, it is about sisterhood, it is about complex history that our family, of complex family history, and I think a lot of people just understand that. It's very universal. So when I'm acquiring a book like this, I try not to, when I present it to the people who make those, the decision about financials, I don't make it small. I think of it as this book. I always think about the book being big, you know, and for the most part, it's worked.
Wow.
I think the editor really, what I love about my job is my publisher deftly puts the decision or puts the, she makes it really obvious that it's the editor's choice. She's always asking us like, what would you like to do and why? And as long as you can answer those things, two questions of like, you know, you want to do this, but why? I've gotten my books through that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, that does answer it very, it does illuminate it. But then now I'm thinking in your situation, you're basically like, a person who gatekeeps, but at the same time, you're wearing a very important hat because you are the producer of a movie, right? You're ushering it, you're developing it, you are the producer, and ultimately the studio is the publisher, the person that you're working for is the studio that writes the check to make the movie happen. Mm-hmm. But you could be wrong, right? You could.
Oh yeah, all the time.
And what happens? Like, is it like a batting average for an editor like me?
I'm sure there is some sort of like P&L that tracks. Yes. No, I feel like there is. There has to be.
There's got
to
like be, right?
Tracking the editor's performance.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting in where you are after 10 years, right? You'd be out of a job.
Yeah. But I think honestly, I think everyone knows that we can't control what readers want. Like, I think readers are, we're like, what is it? I'm trying to compare it to some other stuff. It's like we are always thinking about the readers and what they want, but sometimes they're free to say no. They just like are disobeying kids or something. Like, they're like, they see what we're offering them. Yeah, they see what we're offering them. Maybe they're not in the mood to read it, or maybe like they just, there's so many reasons why readers don't pick up a book, and that's something we cannot control at all. So we know that, like we know that we can put books out there on tables for them, and then but they can just walk past it, you know.
And this doesn't bother you at all?
Oh, it bothers me all the time because I just want to like be able to transport into bookstores and like reach the readers and be like, read this book kind of thing, you know, like I want them to, like, that'd be dangerous, right?
Really
if editors are given, if they can teleport and like and like appear in front of the readers and be like, read this or else kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. That's the real you that I wanted to hear. I mean, honestly, because
oh yeah.
I can imagine being you. Like for me, I would be like, wait a minute, I worked on this for years. I want to reach through the bookstore and grab somebody's neck and go, you gotta read this. This is amazing.
Yeah. So I'm frustrated by that, but also again, think positively because I won't be able to function if I think negatively. Like I also think that books find their readers, readers mm-hmm. find the books.
Yeah.
What I love about a print book is that it's sort of like books get passed down like with family and then between friends. The book like travels among other people. Like I love that of people can discover books no matter what. So even if a book doesn't hit a bestseller and they don't sell as many copies as you hoped it would, like the number will always like increase. Like it's going to increase over time. I really feel as if the book will find its readers. So I think
Can you get into that? Because that's a really interesting point. I don't want to gloss over that.
No, no.
You said that eventually the numbers will increase. And that makes sense because as you know, as it's out there, people will connect and then word of mouth will push it and there'll be new.
So important, yeah.
Right, but that is that true in every situation? That the books don't decline and it just, there's this slow, gradual readership?
I mean, I won't say like, it's for every book, but yeah, they're for most books. Yeah. Yeah. I would say like, you know, I check in once in a while with the books that I published maybe 6 months ago, a year ago. And I see, okay, there's still at least like 5 books being sold. Like, and I'm wondering about the 5 books and how they discovered the book. And, it's nice to think about. And then there's a book that I checked, I didn't check for a while and then I checked it again and I was like, wow, like, you know, I'm trying to figure out like how that kind of picked up so many new readers.
And are you able to track what happened? Like there was an event and, you know, something happened. The author, you know, got into a weird life situation and all of a sudden something was written about that person. How does that
work? Yeah, for the most part, if it's a recent surge in numbers, we can figure out how because, you know, there's marketing publicity. They have more tools for that where they can track social media presence. There's Google alerts that can say, can show, oh, this book was recommended by this and that. For the most part, we can sort of pin it if it's recent. If it's like old and like if the book is old, but there's a surge in numbers at some point, it's really hard to kind of go back in time and figure out what happened during that week that made these numbers pop. But we do have some tools, which helps.
So getting published is a big deal, right? It's like if you land on a Simon & Schuster roster, this is a big deal. Like you're now a published author at a big publishing house. But what about the authors that don't get these deals? What am I supposed to think about those authors? Because Kenneth Wynn, I come into this world with a weird natural bias, for the stamp of approval. And it's just a sickness. I think, you know, the Vietnamese culture from my parents pushed onto me. Be like, yo, if you don't get this imprimatur of saying Simon & Schuster published this, you know, then you're not a real writer, you know? Can you kind of walk me through that and destigmatize that for me? Because I think that's a sickness. That's a sickness.
Is a sickness. And I know a lot of authors who suffer from this where they're not published by like a big 5 publisher. I don't know. But I think it's like, you matter. You matter. Like you don't need something that's like material to like define who you are, define your worth. I think it's a plus. I really think it's not necessary. It's just a plus. And I don't know. I know this is like writers are listening, probably going to listen to this and be like, this is easy for you to say.
I'll make an analogy. As a musician, if you're a singer-songwriter and you write your music and you pick up a guitar, piano, and you just start to record your music and you put it on YouTube and it just travels and then it goes to Spotify, you put it on Spotify, it travels, and then you get like 1,000 or 2,000 sort of dedicated fans and you can start touring in small clubs throughout the big cities, right? You could over time theoretically build up a listenership, a fan base, and you could make a real living if you go hard enough and if you improve your sound and your flavor and your offerings and you do merchandise. You can do it without the backing of a label. The label equals the film studio. Film studio equals a publishing company, right? So you could take the gatekeepers out of in the music industry, which is beautiful. But I feel like in the music industry, you can do it in the film industry too. You could make an indie film and then submit it yourself to all the film festivals. But as a Vietnamese writer, being self-published is sort of not at the level of the support and all of the eyes and ears that you have at a publishing house getting the book out to the major market.
Hmm. I think the writer has to like ask themselves, like, is someone reading, like, do I have like at least one reader that has read this book and loved it and reached out and said, this book has changed my life? I mean, I think that's, think of that one reader, I guess.
Yeah.
I think it's really, it's not easy to do, but you shouldn't really compare yourself to other people. Because what they're going through, the people who maybe they seem to have it all, maybe it's not as perfect as you think it is. Like, you can only see from the outside, not the inside. So, I just think, like, there's other things that matter. I don't know. I'm not really good at comforting people, as you can see. But I really think, like, I think just because you're not published by SNS or the other big five publishers, I think you'll, if you keep at it and work on your writing, and you'll find readers in some way. Like, it might not be the amount, that number of readers that you are imagining in your head, but if it's reaching someone, like one person, and really impacting their life, like, I think that's what's really important.
Is there also a different question to this conversation, which is, the big five are looking for commercial viability. They're looking for commercial stories. They're looking for, you know, Marvel, DC is putting out, you know, things that are palatable for the mass mainstream, right? And perhaps it's not about quality to a publisher as much as commercial viability. I mean, obviously the quality has to be there, but is there, I guess my question is, in the nuance of quality being equal, is the subject matter perhaps something that keeps people outside of the publishing gates? You know, it might be really good writing, but we just don't see a path to sell X amount of books. We don't see how we can invest our time and energy source into this project, because although it's really interesting, we just don't think it'll have buyers.
Yeah, I think that exists. For me personally, I go for quality, believing that eventually it'll lead to commercial success. Again, positively. I think that happens. Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. Have you been to Vietnam?
Yes, I have. Yeah. 3 times at like different parts of my life. So I went when I was 10. I went when I was around 1920, and then when I went, it was like pre-COVID, so right before COVID. So when I was like around 29, I think, years old. So 3 times at different parts of my life, almost a decade apart from each other. And that was wonderful. I really want to go back, actually. I want to go back and experience that, like in Vietnam, because my mom always talks about it.
Do you ever think about it?
Have you been?
Yeah, I go twice a year. To Vietnam for the last 20 years.
Amazing.
Average of, 1.5 times a year, you know, if you average it out. My brother lives in Vietnam. He's been there for 20 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I go back to visit him. And, you know, obviously we have a lot of family that are friends and family that are from the United States that are living in Vietnam now. Guys I went to college with, other people in the film business are living in Vietnam. So over the years, it's like a second home to me now.
Cool.
And I always ask this question. Basically, it's like for people like you in the publishing industry, do you ever look at the industry in Vietnam as it relates and pertains to publishing?
I would say no, I haven't actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine it being anywhere near or similar to the way it's done here because of copyright, because, you know,
censorship.
All the protection, censorship, all of it. There's really a lot of different things that make it drastically different from the United States publishing game.
Yeah. I believe, wasn't it Viet Thanh Nguyen's, like, I think the Refugees short story collection, I think, wasn't there like one story that was censored or something?
I think most of his work is censored.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Most
I feel like I think I bought, when I was in Vietnam, I did buy one of his books. I think it was the short story collection. I remember reading, hopefully it was him actually.
I think you can buy some of this stuff on the street. You know, like there's bootleg copies and you can buy those on the street. But I mean,
the one I got was a bookstore. Yeah.
Yeah. Bookstore. I think it's very rare that any of Viet Thanh Nguyen's stuff is in the bookstores.
Yeah.
It's just it's a very different place. And I wonder how that works, because if you don't have money to kind of push the marketing and the quality, the production of the literature, how do you get it to the level of the way that the United States does publishing?
Yeah, I would love to know that. I imagine, it's really hard over there.
Because you have protections here, and the protection put legs on the investment, and without the investment money, you can't develop writers and you can't develop the trajectory of a manuscript. And, you know, all of those things are so, it matters to the quality of an industry. And if you want to get the industry and the thought process and the intellectual property to this high level, you got to have the proper infrastructure in place to bring all these things up to the highest points.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Luan, thank you so much for spending time with me. I really was looking forward to our podcast, because this is a parallel industry to the film game, the music game, all the creative people that we have on the podcast. You are one of the people in that world that really can explain how we as striving artists in the Vietnamese community can get to the next level by breaking down the backside of how these things work.
I'm honored to be on the podcast. I've watched a few of them and I just love it. And I love the fact that there's so many Vietnamese creatives out there. I feel like we are at a good point in history. I think there's like a wave of more creatives that are coming up, especially from the younger generation. So I'm really excited about that.
It's a good time to be Vietnamese. And shout out to Carolyn Nguyen.
Yes.
Putting it together.
Yes. Heart for Carolyn. But yeah, thank you. I actually want to, I mean, this could be cut off from the podcast, but I do want to recommend someone else that like came up on my radar in terms of like, he's a voice actor on the anime side, and he's Vietnamese. His name is Alex Le. If you've Alex with it's A-L-E-K-S.
We're gonna keep
Have
this.
Have you heard
in
of
the
him?
We're gonna keep this in the podcast because we'll get Alex on, and this
is a
wonderful thing to kind of like have that continuity, you know? From
I don't know why, but the feed like because I've been catching up on Solo Leveling, which is an anime and a manga, and I just saw like a quick YouTube short where he was going through how he voices the main character, and he does a really good job. He does the English dub for this character, so.
We'll reach out, but thank you so much, Lon, and I'm gonna explore him.
Cool. Fingers crossed. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.